Hey, good evening, Bob. This is Enemy Sessions number 3. We've got here in New Zealand, the time is 9 p.m. and it's April the 5th, which makes it April the 4th in Hawaii. Welcome. Let's see what we can get into. We're over at Inscriptorium, and I believe we're through to January. We're picking up. They were awed by Empson, like rustics.
Yes, and that's McLuhan talking about Northrop Frye and Wimsatt. Is it William Wimsatt? Wilfred Wimsatt? Anyways, Wimsatt, the guy from Yale, an old friend. Wimsatt is William K. Wimsatt. All right, so it's titled, They Were Awed by Empson Like Rustics. And this is January 18th, 2011 by Andrew McLuhan. And the actual writing was January 13th. So it says, it is a particular delight when I come across something more than marginal notations in my cataloging of the library. Sometimes it will be an enigmatic short notation, such as, quote, urban congestion as psychedelic anesthesia, unquote, in brackets, see previous posts, so titled, end of bracket. Other times it will be handwritten quotes from other authors like G.K. Chesterton. Coming across something personal like the slightly over a page note below is quite rare. I've gone through over 600 books now, and this is the first example I've seen thus far. Then Andrew gives the cast of the personal note. The cast. Northrop Frye was a colleague of Marshall's at the University of Toronto. They had a famous rivalry, which, as I don't completely understand it, I won't try to illustrate it here. Well, maybe we can throw some light on that. Wimsatt is William K. Wimsatt, Jr. The library contains several of his books on Alexander Pope and Samuel Johnson, gifts of the author with nice inscriptions, for instance, in the portraits of Alexander Pope. Wimsatt writes, quote, for Marshall and Corinne, this accidental exercise in non-visual seeing with affectionate greetings from Bill and Margaret, April 12th, 1966. Non-visual seeing, that's like the tactile eye. That's interesting. So he seems to know how to cozy up to McLuhan and McLuhan's biases or preferences. Then Andrew quotes the name Richards and says, that's I.A. Richards, professor at Cambridge University, when Marshall attended, the author of Practical Criticism, hugely influential in Marshall's intellectual development and work. Before Marshall published, then Andrew continues, before Marshall published The Mechanical Bride and became involved with media and communication theory, he was a literary critic. A lot of the books in his library are review copies sent by publishers or authors hopeful of a McLuhan review. Many people don't realize what a formidable writer he was because many people only know Marshall through sound bites or more well-known works like The Mechanical Bride or The Medium is the Massage. When he says that Marshall became involved with media and communication theory, before that he was a literary critic, but Marshall's literary criticism in 52-53 talks about Wyndham Lewis's theory of communication. So some of the great pieces in the Interior Landscape that came out in 1969 are when Marshall was talking about his heroes, his influences as communication theorists. So it always, you know, what would you say that he was not doing, thinking of communication theory or the theory of communication of a subject in the 40s? He was technically a literary critic. Here I have something to say. By 45, 46, he's starting to see the limitations of F.R. Leavis and I.A. Richards as pertaining to the new magazine media and Hollywood media he was looking at. And that's important to know. You've read Typhon in America. Isn't that past? That's post-literary critic McLuhan. That's McLuhan talking about the media, not using the term media or communication theory, but he is looking at the new post-literate entertainment landscapes, right?
Yeah, in a certain sense, it's his cultural. It's almost cultural criticism. He hasn't fully crossed over the line into, you know, where he's going to be next. But one of the common patterns, at least that I noticed, was with McLuhan, he definitely operates on a decade by decade basis. And halfway through the decade, every time you can start seeing in his private works or whatever, he's starting to work out what he's going to do in the following decade. And it's pretty mechanical throughout his whole career. So in that 45, 46 period, there are definitely the seeds of everything that would be published in the 50s.
Right. So I had a pattern that whenever a new medium came in, McLuhan would get ill, and then he would change his content. So definitely television is – he has the atomic bomb. This has not been mentioned. The atomic bomb is a new environment in 45, 46, and he talks about the effects of that. And we've discussed the appeal of the Southern lifestyle, the Southern character as appropriate to the new fatalism that the atomic bomb evoked in the global population. And then when TV comes in, he shifts to Wyndham Lewis. He also gets he's ill from 46 to 51 while doing the Mechanical Bride. Then he gets ill around 59, 60, and that's when you're moving out of the 50s criticism of explorations into the satellite effect. So satellite creates a new McLuhan, and as quickly as 61, 62, he's talking about satellite making TV an art form. Then you have what I would call the digital or the computer comes in the late 60s. War and Peace in the Global Village is about that, and that's when he has his brain surgery. Then the instant replay comes in the early 70s, and that's when he has the famous weird thing going on with his neck. He needs to have neck surgery or some kind of surgery, and that's when they discover the vein, the odd vein. You remember that?
Copeland says is only shared by tigers or something like this.
Right. So they discover that, and so he's saved by that in the early 70s. And the new technology that's causing the new stresses in McLuhan, so to speak, is the instant replay. And then he gets...
So what killed him, Bob? What technology killed McLuhan?
We're coming to that. And so then in 76, he had a stroke or two. And I think Scott Taylor told me somebody said he had a whole bunch of strokes. Very frequent, little strokes all the time in the 70s. So there was some crisis in 76. So that would be, for me, the beginning of the Android meme and virtual reality. You've done the instant replay. Let's see. And the beginning of the Walkman and the VCR. They're not – I don't think they're – you have the answering machine in the late 70s. So Marshall is – his whole analog media thing that Scott Taylor says is his foundational soul frame of his soul, is going to be canceled in the late 70s. The digital will win out against the analog. And we were talking about today on MUM number 6, Scott Taylor was pointing out that was a big major topic in the late 70s, analog computer versus digital computer, and I heard Marshall talking about it. That got lost in 70. He lost that in 79 and 80. So I would say the digital knocked him out in 79 and 80. You see what I'm saying? And that's the Android meme. That's the replay of media. The Android meme is going to replay the extensions of man, but be extensions within its own dynamic. Extensions of the machine within themselves. So McLuhan's thesis of cracking the code of machines as being extension of the senses is not applicable to the digital simulation. Now, he, in broad terms, saw that with some of the final quotes he made, especially the one about the laser beam scrubbing the audience of the intellect and the human dreams off the court decks. That's a perception of... something past what he had formulated. So he didn't survive that. He lost. He lost in 79. He was knockout punched by the digital, by the digital android meme, and McLuhan was not desirous of staying around anymore. Also, he was. We're going to hear from David Greenberg about his attempt in the late 70s to go into television and make a Jacob Bronowski, The Ascent of Man kind of TV series, focusing on the history of media. So there was a crisis in the late 70s, and he didn't make it through that one. As far as we know, maybe he faked his death. Maybe he's still around. Okay, so you follow what I'm saying?
I followed the pattern through. I was just going to suggest that you actually raised a good question. This, you know, what do you actually call McLuhan's apparently literary criticism? It's, I think Don touched on it, but not too many people have actually dived on in and tried to articulate what is substantially different about McLuhan's apparently literary criticism.
Yeah, here's something I remember. Peter Montgomery says, as a student of Marshall in the early 60s, 61, 62, he recalls getting the impression, you know, as a young student, I don't know what evidence he saw of it, but he had the impression that Marshall was not interested in literary criticism by 62. And the interior landscape goes from 43 to 62. So he was letting his guard down and not even interested in the Gutenberg Galaxy as the Gutenberg Galaxy came out and wrapped it up. And that is his pinnacle of his literary criticism, is the Gutenberg Galaxy. So you have the 40s. He has a facility with the practical criticism and a perceptive figure ground study of the great writers. And so he does it with a flourish because he's actually thinking about something new, which the Mechanical Bride is showing. So, yeah, the 40s replays the 30s. The 50s replay the first, the first half of the 40s replay the 30s. The second half of the 40s, he's going to produce Mechanical Bride. So the second half of the 50s is going to lay out what he expresses about television in the first half of the 50s. Because he does that essay, Technology and Culture, is it? As a political art form in 1953, you know, the month that he gets tenure. And that lays out the TV dynamics right there in that essay.
There's one thing I've been wanting to check with you for some time is actually, as I understand it, the television was in the United Kingdom quite considerably earlier than it was in the United States. And at the same time that McLuhan was actually in the UK doing his studies. And so in a certain sense, he got an incredible head start when he came back to the United States.
Well, I have to check that. They have a broadcast in 1939. And they have some intellectuals on, and Wyndham Lewis is on one of those broadcasts. I think it's Jeffrey Myers' biography called The Enemy. Look that up and read that section where here's Lewis just getting ready to leave because of the war. Goes on TV in 39, and it's very interesting that he's doing what Joyce is writing about, Shem and Sean on a TV debate, Lewis being Shem or Sean, actually does it. He gets on TV. That's what's pretty amazing. So there was a bit of TV to the point that happened, but the war may have interrupted it, and it may not have got really going to the late 40s like the States.
Well, the public television starts in the United Kingdom in 1936.
Right, but I don't think there's much of it, and it gets aborted by World War II.
Yeah, fair enough.
Yeah, but the important thing is that Wyndham Lewis gets on the public TV, on whatever that TV, whatever it's called, the BBC or whatever. That's pretty significant, that Lewis, one of the few people, you know, he's an ostracized person in the late 30s, yet he gets on the new medium. And I'd love to see that. I don't know. I have to look up the biography. If there's any record of that, it's just a diary note or some newspaper article or something. But is there footage of that? And I think Jeffrey Myers, I don't know, in my mind, Lewis didn't do well on it.
No, those guys would have been terrible on television.
Okay, so let's just say that they're starting to use the TV becomes an environment in the late 40s because there's not enough people getting it in the 30s to be an environment.
All right? It's a very powerful anti-environment in 36. Like late 30s, it would have been it's anti-environmental.
That's a ridiculous statement. Nothing is anti-environmental unless it's an environment. Okay? A Gutenberg artifacts can pretend to be anti-environments conceptually, but on a perceptual level, what's the anti-environment to radio? Not a couple of TV shows.
Well, insofar as it's coming in as a new environment, and it's like a new technology begins its life as anti-environment, it moves into environment, and then as it becomes obsolete, it becomes anti-environmental.
A new environment is not anti-environment. Actually, if you actually have a new environment as radio, a new invisible environment, the anti-environment is radio. The past. The past is the anti-environment. And then the art products play off that interface. The crack in the rearview mirror. Remember that 1965 essay?
Yeah.
The rearview mirror is the art form and general environmental terms. So that's that's not exactly accurate what I'm saying, but it's something you have to consider. The new environment is not anti-environment. It's only... No, it isn't. How could it be? It's environment.
No, the new technology is anti-environment.
It's not anti-environment. It disrupts the old environment, but it's done... how is it done? It's done obliquely or not noticed. The anti-environment is noticed. That's art. Art is taking a past medium and making it give attention, getting attention to it, and using it. Usually it's expressing the new dynamic in the old form. Like Cubism is an anti-environment to the telegraph press. And what does Cubism do? It adopts the mosaic of the implied effect of the telegraph press for a visual medium. You see what I'm saying there? Cubism is anti-environmental. It takes an old technology, the paint, the frame, and creates a new bizarre content which is mirroring exactly the hidden ground.
Yep. No, I hear what you're saying. I'm just searching the archive because I've got McLuhan on record talking about the satellite when it comes in as anti-environmental.
Well, that's an eccentric way to use the term. Because that's not, you see, when satellite comes in, television is art form. And art form is anti-environmental. Now, there's the populist meaning of art form where it just becomes what everybody starts to notice. You know, when TV comes in, people start to re-look at movies with a new aesthetic appreciation or investing their cultural values in it. You see? But... And that could be considered anti-environmental. See, there is in the essay, I think it's in the one in 65, The Crack in the Rearview Mirror, it's in there that he says the rearview mirror is, which we think of as the past, is an art form. And that's not developed much. So maybe being tactile, he's going to go up and down the spectrum and then push the envelope by saying the satellite's anti-environmental to what's given. I think it's true, but not... Not developed enough.
Yeah. Well, where was he talking about? He talks about also the Beatles as being anti-environment.
Yeah, that's the radio environment. The radio becomes an anti-environment to television, the hidden ground of television, and the Beatles adopt the dynamic of TV. You know, low visual definition and blurry hair and. Fuzzy, non-individualistic, not being like Elvis, being a tribal four people, that is expressing the effect of television in the old medium.
Yeah.
But everybody takes it as radio, so it revitalized the radio, and radio is a distraction from the TV effect. It's what everybody gets involved in, and they think that the Beatles are a phenomenal new... they almost see it as... It's interesting. People do not see the Beatles as anti-environmental, though maybe the kids identify with it somehow being anti the adult music, but it's also seen as the new. This is new and exciting. And they don't know that the exciting part of the Beatles is the Beatles have the ground of black and white TV, which was the ground in the 50s. They've taken on the textures of TV and actually are not radio. They're mixed media. They're the clothes, the programmed environment that their manager created. They're actually TV disguised as radio, or the TV gloss. You see that point there?
Yeah, no, I'm comfortable with that.
Yeah, like people thought that the Beatles was new music, but it was television. And then you could make it even more refined that since satellite was the ground in the 60s, TV became art form, but radio created the medium of launch pad for the Beatles to enter TV and made TV an art form when they got on Ed Sullivan and then made a few movies and videos. Short, whatever you call those kinescope things. Maybe they're videos, but not video per se. But they made little short movies. What?
What do you call them? Quarktoons, in the sense.
Quarktoons is Quarktoons is that's something to be developed.
okay, so we'll keep it legit. But like, I quite like the phrase. I thought it's
Quarktoon would be a digression.
Yep.
The point is, I hope we're getting people to think about it. It's not cut and dried about what is the art form, the role of the art form. Because when movies become art form, because TV's the ground, that's a somnambulistic response. That's people not noticing the television effect and wallowing in the rearview mirror as a numb reflex reaction. It's McLuhan commenting on movies as being an art form and a reflex reaction, always the previous environment becomes art form. That's an anti-environmental position. What Marshall is pointing out, he's using speech and his books to point out that it's a knee-jerk reaction to engage in the movie as art form. It's totally natural. So, and then you have to look at the new art at that time. Maybe like John Cage at the time the Beatles is reflecting the response of the satellite. He's making art resonant with the hidden ground of satellite. Like the more avant-garde artists are picking up in the new sensibilities a level past the Beatles. But the Beatles are strong and... It's complex. I hope I'm making it complex. It's not cut and dry. There's different meanings of art form. So, yes, you could say the new environment is anti-environmental, but what about the Beatles being anti-environmental? And they're the content of TV.
Yeah, no, I think complexification is much in order.
Yeah. So, and it was that article, The Crack in the Rearview Mirror, that opened that up for me for complexity, because he was pointing out that you couldn't have a rearview mirror anymore. In other words, the only way to have an anti environment was to turn off television, to program the environment, turn off whole environments. That was the only way. He writes at that time in The Emperor's New Clothes, I think, that art essay, Our Essay on Art, for Structuralist magazine. I think that's 1966. He writes about... how the object is not an art form anymore.
Yeah, I think that's probably a topic we should take up at length in the seminars, is like the impossible anti-environment and whether it was possible, how it's possible, and what form it would take.
Right. So we're talking about this because Wyndham Lewis and TV, what did we say here? He was talking about, McLuhan is a literary critic. Yeah, so you can see in the late 40s, he's thinking the early 50s, but apparently being a literary critic. In those essays in Renaissance, which are 1950, they begin, you start to see Renaissance presents Marshall post-literary critic, but still being a critic, but bringing in the media dynamics. Visual and acoustic space. And so then the late 50s is him thinking about the satellite, and then that becomes the ground for his criticism. No, that becomes the ground for the two books, Gutenberg Galaxy and Understanding Media. So then the end of the 60s, he's looking at the global theater as an environment and thinking stuff that'll show up in the early 70s. The talking about the brains, the left brain and the right brain, and the figure ground relationships of that is him thinking about the Android meme.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, so he finds out the left brain, right brain stuff in the early 70s, writes about it in the later 70s, and yet he's thinking about the Android meme, but it doesn't get articulated. He doesn't make it. But he's starting to look at some interesting, you just get glimpses of it in his interviews with Bruce Powers in the Global Village book.
Yeah, I thought Scott Taylor's word today, electrocracy, where he's got the situations of machines talking about machines, you know, the logical extension of when our extensions of ourselves start to hybridize and become autonomous, which is, I think McLuhan lays that pattern out, or at least in very, almost in the fine print of Understanding Media. And it's, I guess if you see that as a significant theme, you can follow it through in later works.
Yeah, Take Today.
Yeah, and so it's not some, eccentric reading or anything like this. It's quite a logical extension of what's in McLuhan's work.
Yeah, he's talking about the bottom-up effects and the top-down bureaucrats, the Pentagon bureaucrats, Tweedledee and Tweedledum. That is accurate because that is Scott Taylor's way of pointing out what's said in page 11 of Take Today, that man is both figure and ground. See, the content is imploding. So as McLuhan said about Watergate, it's an information hunt and a man hunt. Because at that point, somebody can be a satellite conductor and control the content, or at least control the content so that McLuhan doesn't get on in a major way. And that's the Pentagon control. And that's more possible in the imploded global theater, just before the fragmentation caused by digital media. You see? So in terms of the Prince of the Air being a great electric engineer, that peaks in the 70s. And then the Antichrist is, the Prince of the Air is dispersed in the 80s and 90s to a new kind of, malign force? Malignant force, the Android meme. So it's appropriate that he talks about the Prince of the Air and the Antichrist in the late 60s, early 70s, because that's the last period of that. So Take Today deals with the Antichrist and sees the decentralization, at least breaking up the implosion of analog media. Now, the digital Android meme has now come full circle, so the Android meme is replaying the stages of technological evolution. So the Android meme right now is over the last 10, 15 years, offering the specter of the Antichrist again within the machinic intelligence. It's replaying it for machines. You see what I'm saying?
Yes.
So so let's go back to... So we're talking about the surface statement that McLuhan and Mechanical Bride, before Marshall published Mechanical Bride and became involved with media and communication theory, he was a literary critic. We're saying that he was stopped being a literary critic by 1945. It's like he says in 1970, I got three or four more books to make, but I'm moving on to newer media.
Well, what I found in the archive was this: there's definitely a transition point that he's pointing to. And you got these two books, The New American Vortex and, as you said, Typhon in America, which both, I think, Marchand and Gordon have pointed to as being forerunners of The Mechanical Bride. But they're quite different, and neither of them came to completion. And they're in this, I guess the simplistic way of presenting them would be to say that they're... a hybrid between literary criticism, cultural criticism, and with, I guess, seeds of media and communication theory in them. And
without Innes. See, he hasn't got Innes at that point.
There's no need for Innes.
Well, no, that I think Innes moves him out of where the incomplete paralysis he got with Titan.
Yeah, no, that's possible. That's possible. Maybe that's an interesting question, as in what exactly did Innes give him? But he's definitely with Joyce. He's definitely with Lewis. He's all the well, for the most part, most of the perceptual tools are there and in motion.
But TV hasn't arrived yet. As an environment, he in explorations the first TV content or TV environmental evidence they bring in is the Republican convention in 1948. Do you remember him talking about that in explorations? They have some memos or something, early studies of the effect of the convention being televised in the States in 1948. So. You know, he's doing Typhon in 46, 47, right?
Yep.
Yeah. So, he I guess he knows TV's coming, but he doesn't, it's not time to talk about it yet. He has to get some, at least he might be thinking about it, but he needs to have some social data produced by other media and other scholars or other novelists or whatever to quote in the late 40s, early 50s. And he doesn't get enough material till 53.
Yeah, I mean, the word television doesn't really start entering into the way he's talking until 51.
Yeah, yeah. So, anyways, that's some complexification around Andrew McLuhan's statement about the before period. When's the before period? For media and media and communication theory. Okay, so he's talking about, yes, he was a formidable writer and he was a great literary critic, and they're very important to understand the Menippean satire part of his work on television and these new environments. When he writes essays like Explorations and articles, he is using the techniques of the vortices to guide his point of view articles.
Perhaps I've got a way of us breaking through. I think McLuhan was a figure who really understood the power of singular words to really, to make the market or to strike a chord with his audiences. Like, we get the sense of when he latched onto that word, communication, how much he would use that to focus his enterprise or something. Whereas, in essence, he's doing everything that he would do later. But when he's given the word or he latches onto that word, which resonates with his audience, he goes.
Yeah, but you know that Don Thiel pointed out, in the last years of Don's life, he was meditating on why McLuhan dropped the word communication in 53, 54.
Oh, yeah, because he likes intercommunication. Communication's too Gnostic or something, huh?
No, it's just he starts to emphasize the word media. Because the Explorations is called communication seminars or something. The word communication is in there, but he doesn't focus on that word. And that's Theo is puzzled by that because it is a major word in the Macy conferences and the MIT people. Like McLuhan, it's almost Theo said he missed the use of the communication word, how that might be more important than media in the long run. I think I got that right, but he definitely, Theo thought he dropped the word communication. So he latched on, the word that made it for him was the word media. And that definitely was an art form, taking an old word from advertising and then making it an archetypal word to cover all technologies.
Yep.
So anyways, I don't know, make any progress here, but let's go along. So here's Andrew saying that he's a formidable writer. But see, that's a writer in the Gutenberg sense. McLuhan was a formidable writer in his explorations and understanding media. It's just that nobody understood how, like Cubism, it was reflecting the cartoon style of the television effect. And So that is, in retrospect, a formidable writer in the non-literary world of understanding media, of that book. And Eric makes his point in his recent talk in Bologna. There's the people who grab onto the media world and like that part of McLuhan, and then there's the literary people who like the book version of McLuhan. And those people like Gutenberg Galassi but don't like understanding media. The media people aren't interested in the media professors and industry people are not interested in Gutenberg Galassi. They go for understanding media. So the split between
New York and Toronto?
Beg your pardon?
Between New York and Toronto?
Yeah, that's a good way to say it, yeah. And he writes about the Penthouse Suite and the New Yorker media, new media elite in Explorations. And so he talks about Annie Hall being the dialogue between LA and New York. Well, for McLuhan, it was a dialogue between New York and Toronto in the 40s and 50s in his own experience, because he would visit there a lot, check out the scene, and then he'd have the advantage of that and the environment to Toronto. So we're saying here what? That you brought up the point about communication, and then what?
I think the crux of the matter was we're trying to get a handle on recategorization of McLuhan's literary criticism, because, even if you accept he was doing literary criticism, McLuhan, he revolutionized what literary criticism was.
Yeah,
even if he didn't go into communication and media, overtly, he would be a really significant figure in and of his own right for having transformed literary criticism.
And he transformed literary criticism with which books?
Oh, it's more his essays, but in a sense, he was well on the way there with Typhon in America, New American Vortex. The bits that get simplified and turned into The Mechanical Bride.
Oh, okay. So you're saying the essays that are published in Interior Landscape from the 40s and 50s are revolutionary?
In a sense,
Typhon, yeah. In America?
Oh, I find them different. They're definitely different from what his peers and contemporaries were turning out. And in some respects, he hasn't been approximated.
Right, that's right. He even said that Jonathan Miller, when he did his book on McLuhan, he said, the guy didn't even check out my whole world of literary critic. He left that out. McLuhan complained about that. I mean, it definitely being a literary critic was a phase. He was a great critic in light of what unfolded. And he actually, as we experienced in a recent MUM, if you go into some of the things he says about vast centuries of literature, he gives the student a way of looking at the broad outline and actually analyzes literature correctly. He offers a new way of categorizing which writers are important and which aren't.
I always go back to that letter where, of McLuhan to Innes, where he lays out sort of his program for the next decade in 51, where he's quite overt that the world of literary studies of English and formerly the classics does have the best. It's got a monopoly on the means of training perception, and so he definitely acknowledges that it's the world that has got the best toolkit.
You mean English? You mean Scrutiny?
Sorry, Scrutiny is the magazine.
Yeah, do you mean that magazine is the toolkit?
No, I mean English in the sense of the discipline, as in the sense of what he was calling literary criticism at that point had the best. How would you say it? It was like the best program of education of the time for training perception.
You mean the English literature was?
Yeah.
Right, but if you read Explorations, he talks about the figure ground of the changes in writerly style and the different figures of the greats in the time of Shakespeare, time of Pope, the 19th century and the 20th century. So it's a figure ground aspect that he brings to it. that is in the 40s and early 50s framed by his new media environment. See, he is preparing literary criticism to fit into what he's going to do with media studies. I mean, once you know his media studies, you go back and read the criticism. The criticism is approached properly from a media dynamic, media figure ground. So he explains the continuity in from Lord Byron into Edgar Poe, and then detective fiction, and then Hollywood.
Yeah, and going the other way, it's all the techniques of reading and the subtleties and differences and modes of analysis. What would you call it? Aesthetic sensitivity come out of that literary studies, and they get transposed into analyzing the contemporary artifacts, contemporary world, and media environments and landscapes.
Yeah, he can't. If you're reviewing Pound's cantos or Joyce's writings, you can't ignore the media dynamics. They don't make sense without that. And so he wraps up Fitting His Wake as a book of media forms in 1953. You don't see him saying that in the early 40s. You get an inkling of that about Fitting His Wake. He says it's a cartoon around 1949-50. So it's a frog being boiled. You know, McLuhan is changing, but not even registering the change. We see his writing registering changes, but he's almost not aware of it. Unless he is aware of it and targets what he's going to do, like that interview in 1970. I'm finished with the books. I got a few more to wrap up, but I'm not in that world anymore. You know, he knows what he's going to do next. Now, he doesn't get into the media as much as he'd like to in the 70s. And then he falls back on making a book called Laws of Media. So he gets into the tetrad. But yep. he is taking on media because he calls it science. He's taking on the new environments and the conceptual establishment that limits the understanding of the environments. So he's taking on the literary aspect of science.